Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And let's pick up right where the BBC just left off, if you were listening to the BBC, with the humanitarian crisis unfolding in the Syrian city of Aleppo. You know, it's so easy to become numb to the war there as it rages on and on year after year. But this appears to be one of those turning points that we can't turn away from, even if we wanted to. The city Aleppo, as you've been hearing, seems to be falling to government forces, and a ceasefire to allow people to get out of the city seems not to be holding. And government army atrocities like extrajudicial killings are being widely reported. At least 82 civilians were reportedly killed, at least 11 women and 13 children in recaptured districts of Aleppo. Here's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
We must do all we can to stop the carnage. All fighters, particularly government forces and their families and their allies, must honor their obligation to respect civilians and abide by the laws of war and human rights.
Easier said than done, unfortunately, Ban Ki-moon. Meanwhile, there seems to be a new Obama administration deployment to Syria just announced the other day. Interesting that it comes in these waning weeks of the Obama administration. So we'll talk about that, too. Joining me now from Beirut to discuss the latest developments in Aleppo is New York Times Beirut bureau chief who covers the region, Anne Barnard. Hi from New York, Anne. Thanks so much for coming on WNYC today.
Thank you so much.
Can I start, since we were just hearing about the siege itself from the BBC, so many of our listeners, can I start with this new Obama administration deployment to Syria? A few hundred extra troops just announced the other day. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, but I believe that has to do with a different battlefield. That's for the area in northeastern Syria where the U.S. Special Forces are working with Kurdish militias and allied Sunni groups to battle the Islamic State, which is, you know, almost a different war from the one in Aleppo.
Explain that to our listeners. How is it a different war?
Well, this is a multifaceted sort of multi-front war, and you know, the battle in Aleppo that's coming to an end game now is really, you could say, the original war between the Syrian government and rebel groups that are trying to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad after protests began in 2011, and there were crackdowns, and eventually people took up arms, and there were foreign fighters that came in and foreign funding, as well as local groups that took up arms, and that became the war that took over most of the country. But then later, Islamic State arose and declared its caliphate in the eastern parts of Syria. And I mean, I'm oversimplifying, of course, but now Islamic State runs areas, you know, in the east of Syria and in the west of Iraq, and that's who's being fighting in Mosul against U.S. and Iraqi forces and militias. So, you know, you have a cross-border war against ISIS that's tried to establish its own so-called state, and Kurdish militias that are trying to establish a semi-autonomous zone in northeast Syria. And, you know, then in Aleppo, a bit further to the west, you have a big battle over the largest city in Syria, which has been divided for the past 4 years between areas controlled by the government and areas controlled by rebel groups, not ISIS, other groups ranging from a Qaeda-linked group to local rebel groups that have been supported by the U.S. and Turkey and other allies.
Those local rebel groups supported by the U.S., are they really, like, Democrats? You know, do they want something like our early conception of the Arab Spring, that these were kind of pro-democracy uprisings in Syria and other countries that now have been co-opted by groups like ISIS because they're just stronger? Is there any reason to think that there's a big difference, though, between one rebel group and another?
Well, there's a big difference between ISIS and the original rebel groups, that's for sure. I mean, ISIS is an extremist group that is seeking to establish its own religiously run state cross-border. These other rebel groups, they've been subsumed in many areas by the Nusra Front, which has actually changed its name now to the Levant Conquest Front, but basically the same group, Qaeda-linked group, that has proved to be one of the toughest and most consistently financed and armed groups. And so more nationalist-oriented rebel groups that came out of army defectors and local people who sought to defend their areas during the war, those groups have in some cases been dominated by the more extreme Qaeda group. Islamic State has fought against all those groups because Islamic State is interested in establishing its own territory. But are they Democrats like Thomas Jefferson? I mean, you know, it's been a civil war now for almost 6 years, and there's been ugliness on all sides. I think from the beginning, a lot of the people that took up arms were, like many rural conservative Syrians, conservative, Muslim, some of them with Islamist political beliefs, but those span a large spectrum. That's not there's a range of Islamist beliefs that go from the extremism of ISIS that wants to kill other religious groups and Muslims who don't go along with their rule, to people who believe that Islam should play a larger role in politics. So I think there are still many gradations, but frankly, in a world where a lot of people are afraid of Islamic terrorism, this has been one of the biggest problems for the original uprising. It failed to distinguish itself from that, at least in the public eye, and there's been really not much willingness to... It's been quite easy for the Syrian government to say, listen, we're just fighting Islamic terrorists, whether that's fair or not.
Listeners, here's an opportunity for you to ask a question about the situation in Syria to the New York Times bureau chief there, Ann Barnard. She's the bureau chief in Beirut covering that region. 212-433-WNYC if you'd like to call in. 212-433-9692 as this government retake of the city of Aleppo seems to be almost complete, or any other aspect of it that you want to ask about. Ann, is there any reason to believe that the government offensive in Aleppo is taking place at this time because of the U.S. election, because of the lame duck status of the Obama administration, or the apparent willingness of Donald Trump to play ball with Russia, which basically means leaving the Assad regime alone?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, if they expect Donald Trump to come in and play ball with Russia, then they didn't need to necessarily be in a rush to take the rest of Aleppo. I think there is some uncertainty in Damascus because Trump is, on the one hand, inclined to work more closely with Russia in Syria and maybe even with the Syrian government. But at the same time, he's very, very against Iran, and he's surrounded himself with people that are very anti-Iran, which, of course, is the other main ally of the Syrian government. So I think there was some uncertainty, and they just saw an opportunity to push ahead. I mean, but the thing we have to remember is that you know, we had a long discussion about the different armed groups just a minute ago, but there are civilians inside. There are people who were part of the original civilian protest movement. There are people who have been working as doctors and humanitarian workers, you know, following humanitarian principles that everybody deserves aid. And those people have been treated by the Syrian government as terrorists. And that's why they have stayed there. Tens of thousands of other people have come out of besieged eastern Aleppo as the neighborhood after neighborhood gets taken by the government. But there are some people who are afraid that they will end up tortured in prison if they come out. So they are really caught between the bombardment and the fear of what would happen to them on the other side. And this is a real crisis right now. There was supposed to be an evacuation of those people. Last night, Russia and Turkey claimed that they had reached a deal about that, and there was great relief, and people started to get ready to leave with mixed feelings because they'd be leaving the city where they'd tried so hard to establish an alternative to the governance of President Assad. And now, within hours, overnight, there was a reversal and the shelling has begun again. So it's a real emotional whiplash for the people of Aleppo and even the people in the government-held side of Aleppo who are now also again experiencing shelling. So it's really just an incredibly frustrating and emotional moment in the war.
Why do you think the ceasefire didn't hold?
Well, as usual, all sides are blaming each other, but what we heard in the middle of the night was that the first group of wounded civilians and fighters were getting ready to leave, and they were stopped by militias. Some people said Iraqi militias, but there's Iraqi militias, Hezbollah, and pro-government Syrian militias, as well as the army that are involved on the government side. Anyway, those forces, according to people inside eastern Aleppo, stopped that convoy from leaving. And they said that the reason was they didn't want to see the fighters from inside eastern Aleppo leave and escape to rebel-held areas unless, at the same time, a rebel siege was lifted on two Shiite villages in another part of northern Syria. So they were looking for a reciprocal gesture on the other side. The problem is, in a fragmented rebel landscape, I'm not sure the people inside eastern Aleppo have much leverage over that. That's up to Turkey and others to influence that. We're talking about civilians and the fighters and their families that are just trapped inside Aleppo with nowhere to go, nothing left to fight with, no more ammunition, no more medical supplies. So, you know, they're just trying to get out. And I think Russia announced the deal without necessarily having the buy-in of the Syrian government or its other main ally, Iran. At the same time, the Russians are blaming the rebels for restarting the fight. But I'm just not sure how likely that is, given that they're really running out of hope. They're crowded into just five neighborhoods. I don't really see how they would want to continue the fight when they had a chance to escape.
Why wouldn't the government just want these people to get out? If they oppose the government and they're going to become refugees and go, I don't know where, but presumably out of the country, why wouldn't the government of Syria be just as happy with that?
Well, they're actually being sent to Idlib province, which is another rebel-held area, although, of course, from there it is on the Turkish border. Maybe some of them will make their way out. It's become a lot harder to cross that border. But essentially, the government has been moving all such people to Idlib with the idea that maybe they can kill them all there sometime later, I mean, to put it bluntly. But why would the government not want them out? You know, there's a lot of anger on the government side. There's been a lot of deaths on all sides. And in past evacuations like this, where there's been a surrender deal from rebels and civilians who have long been besieged and bombed by the government, they agreed to get out. There's a deal to move them out on buses, sometimes with their light personal weapons, to a rebel-held area. There are people on the government side who resent that, who are angry and say, you know, these people shouldn't be allowed to get away, essentially. And there have been efforts to sabotage those ceasefires. So it may be something like that. It may be a power struggle within the alliance between Iran and Russia. It could be a lot of things.
Let's take a phone call. Here's Abdullah in Nassau County. You're on WNYC with Ann Barnard, New York Times bureau chief in Beirut. Hi, Abdullah.
Hi, how are you? I just want to remind our chief speaker from Beirut that she didn't mention anything about the Russians and the regime. They are the ones who are bombing the only air for years. And also right now on the ground, a lot of people, if they want to leave, they cannot leave. Due to continuation of bombing. And the United Nations is not involved. They're not getting anywhere with it. Okay? The other thing is the militias and Iran. Even there is an agreement between Turkey and Russia, right? They still don't want them to leave. They want to kill them on the spot. They take anybody below 40 and they join them into the army of the government, and they send them all the way to somewhere and to join the army. So that's something really we need to focus on. The United Nations, everybody is watching. There's 300,000 people. They've been killed. Every single day, bombed everywhere. There is no way to leave. They want to demolish them. Another Western Hitler, okay? So that's really something I want to mention, because we're from that region. We see atrocity every single day, every single minute. Why the bombs does not stop? And I leave with another question. Why United Nations and others were not allowed the humanity to be dropped off from the air like they've done it in Iraq and everybody else?
How would you answer that question? since you asked it. How would
I didn't quite hear the last question.
Yeah, let me ask Abdullah. How would you answer that? Because it seems to be, in a way, a rhetorical question. Why wouldn't UN relief be allowed in?
Because the Syrian regime takes everything that coming from the United Nations, and they control it, and they sell it on the street to the people. They go and sell it on the street, and that's with the staff of United Nations, okay, in Syria.
Abdullah, what would you like to see the West do, or anybody?
I would like to see, truth talk, number one, I would like to see United States more involvement, not to be relaxed back, because they had every single Syrian. By the way, the fighters, they are average people. They have no choice. They didn't have no choice. They lost everything for 4 years. Imagine you get bombs every single day. Every single day, with every bomb that you dream of, there is nothing left anymore, from buildings. Now, what I see, Iran has to be stopped. Hezbollah should be announced as a criminal, and they have not been. And also, the Assad, he has not been the person internationally that he's a war criminal. Why no one will put him as a war criminal? And then also, we have the capacity to drop off humanity from the air. But that's we are capable of
humanitarian
that.
Aid from the air.
We've done it in the North Syria for the Kurds where we wanted to, and we told the Russians stop, and they did.
Abdullah, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Please call us again. Anne, go ahead.
If I could respond to Abdullah a little bit, yes, I did mention these things, but let's mention them in some more detail. I mean, this is one of the most extraordinary wars that we've all witnessed, seeing a government bomb its own cities and, indiscriminately bomb areas that have fallen out of its control. This is seen as a strategy called starve or surrender. They besiege areas, they bombard them, they keep out food and medicine, and eventually when the people are exhausted and the fighters are exhausted, they strike a deal for them to leave, and those people don't know when or if they'll be able to come back to their homes. You know, this is something that is challenging the whole concept of international human rights law. Of course, that's something that's usually honored in the breach. There's all kinds of violations of laws of war, including by the United States. But this is a case where we've watched really extreme cases unfold, and there hasn't been, any leverage internationally to do anything about it, it seems. So, I think this is really a turning point in Aleppo. This is happening in front of us, and people are stuck inside who are, of course, there's fighters inside, but there are many civilians inside, and there doesn't seem to be any ability to get them out and to stop them from being under the bombs. People have also been shelled in western Aleppo indiscriminately, but we're talking about something that doesn't compare to the full power of a state army then aided by Russia unleashing, its air force and artillery on a population. So that is something that is at the heart of the matter here.
Let's take another call from a Syrian American. Here's Sadi in Manhattan, who says he's from Aleppo. Sadi, turn your radio off so we don't have the delay, and welcome to WNYC.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity. I very appreciate it. Actually, I'm Syrian from Aleppo, and just I came recently, I was in September there to see my family. Those terrorists, they must be eliminated. They are not rebels. They are not moderate opposition. They all terrorists trained in Turkey. They came over from all over. They merged with Al-Qaeda. They call them ISIS. They call them too many faculty, too many terrorists. They must eliminate it. And the United States, they should stop arming and training those troops. They can't rule the country. They cannot take over. Those not belong to us. Those not belong to our society. Syria was a peaceful country, a great country, a very nice country, nice people, 6 years ago. So do we learn from Iraq? Do we learn from Libya, Yemen, Saudi Arabia bombing Yemen every day in the daily basis? Where's the humanity? Where's the human rights?
Sadi, if the rebels are terrorists...
They're all terrorists, sir. I have a friend of mine. They used to be in the college. They merged with them. They're trying to collect people to be joined together. Friend of mine, I lost them. I tried to be peacefully speak with them, say this is wrong, what you don't, this is wrong. So they say, no, we have to take over the country. Take over the country from who? The country ruling by the government.
Maybe there's no good guy sides left in terms of those doing the actual fighting. But how would you compare what you just described about the rebels with the atrocities of the Assad regime?
Sir, the Assad regime, the legal government, Assad elected by 11 million people in 2014. And this is legal government. We have no right to overthrow the government. Do we learn from Iraq or Libya? Where's Libya now? Tell me. Can you tell me where we are in Libya?
Right, Libya after Gaddafi was taken out by that Western invasion, kind of also going toward chaos. Saadi, thank you very much for your call. And let me follow up on that call with our guest, Ann Barnard, who covers Syria for the New York Times. She's in Beirut today. Wow, there's a lot in there, Ann. First of all, on the notion of the Assad government as elected, would you fact check that? Were they elected in 2014?
They're elected in a country where dissent is punishable by prison and torture. So sure, they're elected, but those running against him have to be approved by the government, and you know, there's no recent history in the past 40 years of Assad family rule of actual free political debate. So, you know, I think, you know, lots of presidents are elected by, you know, 90% of the vote, and we know that that's not exactly a real election. So I think lots of Syrians would love to see real internationally monitored elections that included all of the refugees, 5 million of them that are outside the country, all the people that are living in rebel-held areas as well as government areas. I think everybody would welcome an election, and I don't think that anyone wants foreign powers to come in and dictate who's going to be the leaders of Syria. I was in Western Aleppo, government-held Aleppo, just last month, and it's true what the caller says, that city has also suffered. There are rebel shells that land. We were at a hospital. We saw innocent people coming in with injuries from shelling, and, you know, mortar shelling in a city is inherently indiscriminate. Any kind of indiscriminate attacks on civilians are war crimes, no matter what the scale. But we have to differentiate between the scale of what's being done by one side and the scale of what's being done by the other side. We also have to keep in mind that a government has responsibilities. They say they're a legitimate government. They're responsible for all of their citizens. And they have not been able to resolve the situation, nor to protect the people in their areas, nor to come to any kind of they haven't shown any willingness to compromise over the political issues that were at the heart of the rebellion in the first place.
What do you think about his comparison of the situation in Syria to that in Iraq or in Libya, where when the West came in to topple dictators, however well-intentioned in part that might have been, the results have been much worse than the status quo?
Well, for sure. I covered the Iraq war. I was based in Iraq for years, not living in the green zone, living in the so-called red zone with Iraqis. And I've witnessed the disaster of the American occupation of Iraq firsthand. I think that's exactly the reason why the White House and most Americans didn't want to see a U.S. invasion to topple President Assad, and neither did most Syrians. Neither did most Syrians within the opposition. The opposition put a lot of reliance on the hope that there would be more robust aid than did come, and maybe many of them now see that as having been a mistake. But they wanted things like a no-fly zone. They wanted things like retaliation, limited retaliation for the use of chemical weapons on a civilian population that killed, you know, more than 1,000 people in the suburbs of Damascus in 2013. When that didn't come, it was taken as a green light that the government could pretty much do anything as long as it said that it was fighting terrorists. So I think it's really a straw man to talk about a U.S. intervention to topple President Assad. I don't think that's ever been on the table in terms of an invasion or any kind of sweeping action. I think the question is, you know, looking back, was there something smarter that could have been done? Is there something smart that can be done now, at least to put down markers and say certain things just are not acceptable? But on the other hand, the U.S. isn't in that mood. It's not in that position. The Obama administration has been more interested in forging a deal with Iran and basically stepping back from the Middle East a bit. But the idea that that the situation in Syria was containable obviously has not panned out. I mean, if you look at the map, Syria is on the brink of Europe. It's the connection between Africa, Asia, and Europe. And you now see this massive migration crisis and an entire country being devastated with unpredictable consequences for the region and the world. So, you know, I don't have a prescription for what should have been done and what should be done now, but it hasn't gone well.
Paige in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Paige.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'll try to be brief. I know she just mentioned those markers and what America could actually do or not have done. And I just would like to hear a little bit more about this catch-22 that I feel we're in. I mean, the atrocities that are being committed, I see these things every day, and they're so incredibly upsetting. But I feel, what can we do? Yes, like she just said, we don't want to get embroiled in another war. That never seems to work out for anybody in the long run anyhow. But at the same time, when we do not get as involved as maybe some of us would like, you know, again, we see terrorist groups crop up in these voids that are left. And it's just such a frustrating situation that I wish I could understand a little bit better. Like, what are some really good options for other countries like America to assist in a way that will create positive change in the long run? Or is there simply no answer to that question? And I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Paige, thank you very much. And I know you already said at the end of your last answer, Anne, that you don't have the answer, but is there anything else you can add to answer Paige's question about options that are seen as being at least potentially on the table?
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, yes, as a reporter, I'm more tasked with covering the situation than with describing options and sort of recommending things. It's not really my role, but what I can talk about is what is out there. That, you know, right now, even those that had called for more support to rebel groups in the past are, in my mind, they fall into two categories. Some of them are sort of acting as though nothing's changed and it's the same as it was in 2012, and you could just, you know, go and give more robust support to those rebels that are fighting Assad and are not affiliated with ISIS. The fact is, you know, things have moved beyond that. It's a really messy situation now. So some are still saying, okay, at least arm those people enough, consistently enough, just a little bit more help could have tipped the balance in Aleppo, at least to force some kind of discussion and negotiations from a position of more leverage. But you have to curb your expectations. That's not going to lead to a, you know, immediate bloodless takeover of Damascus by a group of Democrats. You know, this isn't on the table anymore. So it was never on the table. So, you know, the option that's being pursued and that is more likely to be pursued by a Trump administration, which is, I see it really more as a continuation than a break with Obama's policy, is to sort of make accommodation with Assad, or at least with Russia, and try to force through some kind of political compromise, at least fig leaf political compromise. The problem is that it's not clear that even now, you know, in a position of more confidence, the Syrian government is in the mood to do that. They seem to take more the attitude that if they're winning, they can win absolutely, and they don't need to compromise, they don't need to share power. You know, there's a wish to share that for more power sharing, even on the pro-government side. You know, before there was even a war, there was some resentment in the in the communities that support Assad, that he wasn't sharing enough power, you know, even within his broad network of support.
Right.
And, you know, his family was profiting from corruption and all kinds of things. So there's a lot of questions about the future. A victorious Assad doesn't follow that then there will be a smooth transition to peace in the country.
And it wasn't that many years ago that people thought that the new young Assad was going to be the more democratic and liberal Assad compared to his father, the dictator, but we see how that's turned out. One thing before you go, because Paige, the last caller, mentioned seeing these heartbreaking messages coming out of Aleppo, and probably a lot of listeners have, on social media, coming via text or Twitter and then being spread around. One Syrian girl in particular, Bana al-Abed, has captured the attention of the world. Do you know Bana al-Abed's story?
Yes, I do. I've actually not focused a lot on Bana, not because I don't think she's real. My colleagues have checked her out. We have every reason to believe that she's real and that she is who she says she is and she is where she says she is. Anybody who's saying she's not, I think, is just, pursuing, trying to confuse the issue as if children aren't actually going through this kind of suffering in eastern Aleppo. It's just not the case. I never really focused on Bana because we have so many sources. We have many people inside eastern Aleppo and other parts of Syria that we can be in contact with. So I didn't feel the need to, focus on a Twitter account that was clearly created in order to spread a message. You know, it seemed very, very orchestrated, which, again, I want to underscore, that doesn't mean that it is not true.
And we will leave it there. Such an informative segment and great phone calls. It was great to hear from Syrian Americans calling in, as well as the last caller who had a great question. So I really want to thank Ann Barnard for all your great information. As we heard from one of the callers, people have been, following your social media posts as well as your actual articles in the New York Times as the bureau chief in Beirut. So thank you very much for your work and for giving us a half hour today.
Thank you. I'm really glad that people care about Syria.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies at NYU and Princeton, Stephen Cohen. He's also with The Nation. And if you think The Nation means we're going to get a certain view on Russia, think again. We're going to get kind of the opposite take than a lot of people have been putting out there. Should be very interesting with Stephen Cohen coming up next.